helping students and healthcare professionals not just survive, but thrive with a purpose. This is the CMDA Student Pulse Podcast with your host, Bill Reichart, National Director of CMDA Campus Ministries.
Well, welcome to another episode of CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast. I'm Bill Reichart, National Director for Campus and Community Ministries here at CMDA. And my guest today is Thaddeus Williams. Thaddeus, welcome.
Hey, it's a joy to be with you, Bill.
Well, let me, before we dive right in, let me give a quick intro. Thaddeus is, he's a teacher at Biola University, but I love the way you frame this in your bio, loves enlarging students' understanding and enjoyment of Jesus. And I think that's a great way to put it. And not only do you teach at Biola, but you are a systematics theology professor, assistant professor at Talbot School of Theology, taught philosophy and literature at Saddleback College, jurisprudence at Trinity Law School, and a lecturer in worldview studies at LaBrie Fellowships in Switzerland and Holland. You reside in California, Southern California, with your wife and four kids. And we're going to be discussing this book, Don't Follow Your Heart. It's the latest book, Thaddeus, that you've written. And we're going to have a great opportunity to explore a little bit about the things in this book. So, again, welcome.
Yeah, it's a joy to be with you. I just got to throw it out at the outset.
Yeah.
That beautiful girl on the cover, that is my 13-year-old Holland. It was actually the inspiration for the book because I played a game with her, and my wife and I play a game with all the kids called Spot the Lie. And whatever they're watching, you know, some Disney cartoon, whatever it might be, if they can point out a falsehood and explain why it's false, they earn $1. And so this was a couple years ago in Holland. She was 10 at the time. She comes joyfully bounding down the stairs. Daddy, Daddy, you owe me another dollar. All right, what'd you find this time, darling?
Yeah.
And she had been watching a commercial for some rainbow pixie princess unicorn. And she said, Daddy, the commercial told me to follow my heart. I said, okay, well, spot the lie. And she said, Daddy, I don't want to follow my heart. My heart is fallen. I'd way rather follow God's heart. And I was just like, oh, that's so beautiful. I wrapped my arms around her. She won $5 for that one. So she's on the cover, and she is very much the inspiration for the book, just seeing how often kids are targeted with the follow your heart message and how beautifully countercultural it is to follow God's heart.
Yeah. Well, you not only touch on that that message that we've often bought into just uncritically. And I think what you had, that conversation you had with your daughter is kind of the conversation you're trying to have with all of us in this book as you explore those 10 commandments of self-worship, as you say. We're not going to do a deep dive in all of them, but you have, I don't know if we want to just give a 10,000 view perspective here. You've got Live Your Best Life, Okay, Boomer, Follow Your Heart, Be True to Yourself, You Do You, YOLO, The Answers Are Within, Authentic, Live the Dream, and Love is Love. And those are the kind of the 10 commandments of self-worship. And I love the way you put them in hashtags too, very culturally relevant. The way that, you know, I mean, you can just, you can picture, and I can picture just how a lot of these statements, especially YOLO, are just, you know, they're hashtagged in every Instagram post or, and the way that we talk about life. So, let's talk about the follow your heart, because I think that's, you know, that's the, you know, that's obviously the way you begin this conversation, the title of your book. What's, I mean, you say your daughter could spot the lie. Why is it that many of us don't spot the lie? What is the lie that we're often embracing?
Yeah, well, it's if you really think deeply about it, and I'm coming at the question as a theologian, it is literally the oldest lie in the book. So follow your heart. It markets itself as very edgy, very innovative, very forward-looking. But if you flip all the way back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 5, we're all familiar with the scene, right? Adam and Eve are in the garden. Along comes a serpent. And the serpent in Genesis 3, 5 makes this this offer. Mm-hmm. It says, Eve, if you eat of the tree, you will be, in the languages, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Mm-hmm. And for years and years, that language just didn't click for me. Mm-hmm. It was pretty baffling. And then some light bulbs started to turn on when I was doing some research. A couple of years back, in a Dutch theologian named Abraham Kuyper. Mm-hmm. And Kuyper points out that the Hebrew word for knowing doesn't have a great English equivalent. It's not like book knowledge. It's not experiential knowledge. Mm-hmm. The closest thing it would be in English would be something like a maker's knowledge. I know it because I made it that way. Mm-hmm. And so the way I illustrated in the book is, you know, one of my old roommates out of college plays bass for a band called Linkin Park. Mm. And when I would ask him questions about his new album they were working on, the Meteora album at the time, I never once stumped him because he knew the songs. Mm. He didn't know them because he studied the sheet music or because he listened to them over and over. He knew them because he made them.
Right.
Right. And that's what's going on in the Hebrew here. The serpent is offering our first parents, you can be the knowing makers of, you can be the sovereign definers of, you can be the ultimate meaning makers over. And then it's followed with the phrase, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Mm-hmm. Well, in ancient Judaism, if we hopped in a time machine and went back to the BCs, we would use opposites to describe everything in between. So as ancient Jews, we might say good and evil to refer to everything, black and white to refer to every color. So this first promise is really follow your heart. Follow your heart. You can be the knowing makers, the sovereign meaning makers, the ultimate definers of your biology. You can define the meaning of marriage. You can define the meaning of existence. And so seen in that biblical light, follow your heart really is just a modern hashtag for what is the oldest lie in history.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, that lie and many of these others that you discuss in the book are sometimes hard to recognize because it's the air we breathe. It's the water we swim in. We almost have to step outside of ourselves or to look with fresh eyes as to how are we believing these lies? And culturally, I mean, how are we believing the lie, follow your heart? How does that come about in its modern day expression, do you often see?
Sure. Well, for starters, just recognize, you said it's the air we breathe, you know, it's the water we're swimming in. There was a poll that came out a couple years ago that found that 84% of Americans, so that's a number large enough to include a large swath of Christians. Mm-hmm. 84% of Americans believe the highest goal of life is to make yourself happy. Mm. So you think of the old Westminster Catechism. What's the chief end of man, right? Why do we exist? To glorify and enjoy God forever. Mm-hmm. 84% of Americans have inverted the creator-creature distinction and said, no, the chief end of man is to glorify and enjoy yourself forever. 86% said to enjoy yourself, to find the happy life, do what you desire most. And then a whopping 91% of Americans, I mean, that's just a super majority, 91% said to find the answers, look within. So what we're dealing with here, I argue in the book, is it's not just a trend. It's not a mere hashtag. It is a world religion. It is a cult.
Right.
With adherence, with its own commandments, its own decalogue, its own core doctrines,
right,
where you serve as the functional deity. So one of the ways this manifests, obviously in the culture right now, the concept of self-ID, self-identification. You see this in European legal systems, how when it comes to questions of transgenderism, there used to be some kind of litmus test to prove that you were actually, say, transgender. And so there had to be maybe hormone therapy, maybe gender reassignment surgery, maybe a certain amount of years living in contradiction to your biological sex, things like that. Well, there's been a huge movement in Europe that has now crossed the big pond and is transpiring in our own backyard here in America, away from that towards what's called self-ID, self-identification. So now all that's required is to feel subjectively to identify as the opposite sex. That's all it takes. And again, think of Genesis 3:5. I'm the knowing maker over. I'm the sovereign definer of everything. And so we have an entire generation that's been raised on some of these dogmas that is now convinced that just because it's the water they're swimming in, because it's the air they breathe, of course you can ID as however you feel, because your feelings are sacred, your feelings are unquestionable, right. Your feelings are authoritative as scripture would be in a Christian tradition. So that's one of the many manifestations of the follow your heart cult in the culture, is that I get to define the meaning of my own biology.
Well, I mean, without any transcendent truth, all we end up doing then is colliding with one another, because our, you know, turning our identity within, finding significance within, all of these things are going to come into conflict with the people around us. It just becomes chaos. It becomes unlivable. And I think we're just starting to discover in the culture just how challenging, as this worldview, as you call it, a cult, is being expressed, that it's not sustainable. And it's...
Sure.
Yeah. And again, it's not the way God created us. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, it cuts against the grain of our own nature. Mm-hmm. It cuts against the grain of reality. And I argue in chapter 9 that when you break reality, when you break the structure of objective reality, reality has a way of sort of breaking us back.
Right.
And so I give one example to your point that this leads to a lot of chaos. I give the example of, I think it was the MTV Music Awards. So it's over 10 years ago now. And it was shocking. It made headlines. It was all the talk around the water cooler, was that the performance of Madonna, Britney Spears, and Christina Aguilera, they sang this anthem to autonomy. That it was essentially a follow your heart tune. And to follow your heart, you need to spit in the face of traditional morality. And so part of what they did for the shock value was they all three of them kissed on stage at the MTV Music Awards, and it was supposed to ruffle everybody's feathers. And then at the very end of the song, they hold hands and they chant in unison, "We are tired of your outdated notion of right and wrong. We're tired," "we're bored with your notion of right and wrong." And so there's this idea of, you know, it goes back to Friedrich Nietzsche, Jean-Paul Sartre, and then all the way back to Genesis 3 with the serpent, that traditional morality needs to be mocked, it needs to be transcended. Well, here's what's interesting. If Madonna, if Britney Spears, if Christina Aguilera, if somebody breaks into their mansion and, let's say, steals their jewelry or steals their platinum records, suddenly that outdated morality of thou shalt not steal becomes a lot less boring to them, right? If they have a stalker who threatens their life, suddenly that old-fashioned morality, thou shalt not murder, becomes a lot less boring to them. If somebody, you know, plagiarizes their music, if somebody, you know, steals their body of work and turns it for a profit, all of a sudden that traditional morality becomes a lot more interesting. And so that's one of the problems with this follow your heart ideology is the idea that you can create your own moral reality, it's just nonsense when it comes to living daily life.
Yeah. It's very true. One of the things I appreciate about the way you set up the book too, Thaddeus, is, you know, you talk about this idea of this cult of self-worship, and you have the Decalogue and the commandments as they're outlined. You call those who would stand outside of that, against that, as heretics.
Yeah.
I love what you're doing there. It's like, you know, you really want to be truly countercultural. You really want to stand against this, become a heretic. And I think for a lot of young people, and not just young people, but, you know, I think that's an inviting opportunity, because, you know, we're really going against the flow. There's nothing new and novel in these things that we think are so avant-garde. And so, no, it's like you said, it's the lie as old as time. To be truly countercultural, be the heretic, stand against it. Explain a little bit about why you chose to take that tact.
Yeah, so part of, I think on the opening page, mm-hmm. I cite the famous atheist, Richard Dawkins. He had a best-selling book. It's pretty dated now, and the whole sort of new atheist movement has waned in popularity. It's sort of a thing in the past now. But Richard Dawkins, in his heyday, wrote the bestseller, The God Delusion. And on the first page, he says something to the effect of, you know, I want to rid you of the superstition of a malevolent, egomaniacal, petty, control freak God. And so I take Dawkins and I subvert what he's saying. And I said, I couldn't agree more with Dawkins. I want to make you an atheist about a petty, control freak, vindictive, power hungry deity. I want to, by the end of this book, I want to convince you to be an atheist. Be an atheist about the God of self. Hmm. Be an atheist about the God of self. And so I find it's useful to take a lot of these concepts and just flip them on their head. So what's behind my call to be heretics against the cult of self-worship? A lot of that is me subverting Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was one of the most clear articulators of the serpent's lie in Genesis 3:5 for the modern era. And so Nietzsche says, you know, most people are like cows, and we sort of moo along with the herd, and the herd morality is tell the truth and be compassionate and care about justice and honesty and fidelity and all these things. And Nietzsche says, don't be a cow. Be a Superman. Be an Übermensch, the overman. Fly above all that. Transcend all of those traditional, pathetic, weakling values and assert your will to power. How do you assert your will to power? By creating your own values, by following your own heart, by being true to yourself. And so I argue that, you know, in Nietzsche's day, here's this herd following traditional morality. Now the Superman is the one who says, to hell with that. I'm going to create my own moral reality. I say that nowadays, there's so many people trying to create their own reality. There's so many people following their own hearts that is the new herd.
Right.
That is the new herd. To be a true Übermensch, to be a Superman in our day, to fly, to transcend the masses, is to actually do these old-fashioned things like worship God instead of yourself. be faithful to your spouse. Tell the truth. Don't take things that aren't yours. Pursue justice. Love your neighbor as yourself. Be honest. That those are the marks of the true countercultural Superman in the 21st century. And so then I sort of add a theological twist to that by saying we need to be heretics against the cult of self-worship. And so every chapter ends with what I call a heretic's field manual. Mm-hmm. And that's where I give down-to-earth suggestions. Here's some things you could do. Here's five things you could do this week that are radically countercultural, that'll help you swim against the tide of self-worship.
Well, you also do another thing at the end of every chapter, too, I wanted to touch on, are the stories. You have J.P. Moreland and Johnny Erickson Tada and Josh McDowell and others give a story. Why was that important to include? How does that fit into what you were trying to accomplish with the message of this book?
Sure. So maybe it's just me, but when I read a lot of theology, one of the things I struggle with is it starts to feel very heady, very head in the clouds, very abstract. And so with my last book, Confronting Injustice Without Compromising Truth, questions Christians should ask about social justice, I'll go into, you know, a 15-page analysis of, you know, say systemic racism or something like that and think it through. And then I realized there's people out there who have experienced the power of the gospel that has drawn them out of far right and far left ideologies. And why not have them, in their own words, share their story? Because that can be exponentially more impactful than my nuanced 10-point argument. And so I did that in the last book, and it ended up being my favorite part of the book by far. You know, there was a neo-Nazi that Jesus saved from white supremacy. And so why not have him share his story about how much more powerful the gospel is than Nazism? And so in this book, I thought I'd carry that tradition forward, and God just opened the doors to some pretty incredible folks. So Johnny Erickson Tada, for those listeners who aren't familiar with her story, had a diving accident as a teenager, left her paraplegic. She's been wheelchair bound ever since. And she says when she looked within after her accident, she found nothing but self-pity and despair. How am I supposed to live my dream now? I can't even walk. And how ultimately the gospel and finding her identity, not in her emotions, because her emotions were down in the dumps, but finding her new identity in what God declares to be true of her, was profoundly liberating. Josh McDowell, one of the greatest apologists of the modern era, shares his story of enduring repeated sexual abuse as a child and how that just marred his heart. He was an emotional wreck. So if he's following his heart, anybody who's endured abuse knows your heart can be pretty mangled. And so he talks about how Jesus put him back together, redeemed him from all that pain and trauma. J.P. Moreland talks about his decades-long battle with anxiety. He has a diagnosis of GAD, generalized anxiety disorder. And so if he's following his heart, he's overwhelmed with anxiety. And so he talks about how Jesus, following God's heart instead of his own anxious heart, was freeing for him. And so I find that, honestly, that's my favorite part of the book is when I'm not saying stuff, but it's people sharing their own story about how God set them free from different forms of self-worship.
Wow. Well, there's a lot we could explore. Again, there's 10 of these that all give a different look into how this cult of self-worship is deceitful, and it does not lead to human flourishing. The one that particularly captured my attention, although all of them did, but YOLO, that one is, you know, you only live once. And I think why it captured my attention was because I found like this was kind of the one of the things that the church, especially, you know, young Christians are often told to do, that the only way to really truly have a meaningful, flourishing Christian life and experience is that you got to do something great for God.
Yeah.
And somehow thinking like it's got to be so spectacular, so adrenaline rushing, but what doing something great for God could be being faithful in the things He calls you to, the mundane, the simple things. And I think we need to hear that message more, that there's, you know, to be faithful in the things that He's called us to, the normal things, the routine things, are just as important, if not more, than looking for that adrenaline rush, that grand adventure, as you say in your book. And anyway, I thought that was kind of a compelling thought as you outlined it.
Yeah, I saw years ago, David Platt wrote the book Radical.
Yeah.
And that book inspired a lot of people, mm-hmm. and God used that book, I think, in a lot mm-hmm. of positive ways. I think one of the unintended side effects of it was if somebody's entering the business world, if somebody's studying for a midterm for a biology test, if somebody's standing in a DMV line, if somebody's sitting in traffic, mm-hmm. it's like, well, this doesn't feel very radical. Right. And, you know, I need to cross an ocean. I need to be swinging from vines in Papua New Guinea to find some unreached people group and translate the Bible into their language and do something extraordinary. I need to be dodging piranhas and anacondas on the Amazon, finding that unreached people group to do something truly radical. And I thought what was extremely helpful was a theologian, is a dear friend of mine, Mike Horton. Mm-hmm. Michael Horton wrote a response book called Ordinary.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Such a good title, mm-hmm. Ordinary. Talking about how part of the beauty of true spirituality, true Christian spirituality, mm. is it doesn't suck you out of the mundane on some mystical quest for a state of spiritual ecstasy. No, true spirituality, the warp and woof of true Christian spirituality is everyday life. Mm-hmm. It is. So at the end of that chapter, my friend Alyssa Poblete talks about her calling as a mother and changing diapers to the glory of God, mm. you know, cleaning up baby barf to the glory of God. I remember years ago, this dawned on me. I was working in a supermarket, working the graveyard shift and hanging cheese on the little racks in the middle of the night, became an act of worship. You can hang cheese in a dairy box of Ralph's for the glory of God. And there's something, very powerful about how Christian spirituality touches all of life.
Mm, yes, indeed. Well, again, thank you for writing this. Thank you for helping us become aware again of the air we breathe and the water we swim in, because so oftentimes we just let this stuff wash over us. We can move forward through life uncritically. And I think this is a wonderful book, especially for our med school, dental school students, our healthcare students, as they're beginning to live out their faith in the vocation that God's called them to. I think this would be the way you've set it up too, it's great for a small group. I think there's an opportunity for discussion. You have that field manual in there. So I think this is just a wonderful gift. And so thank you for and for capturing that moment with your daughter that allowed you to kind of spin off into this these thoughts and helping us kind of unpack this. Sure. and the call. And I love at the end, you've got people signing off on a call to be a heretic. And I trust people, as they get through this book, will come to the end of it and say, yes, sign me up. I want to be a heretic too.
Yeah. So if folks want to do that, they can visit jointheheretics.com.
Okay.
So no www, just jointheheretics.com.
Okay.
You can read the Heretics Manifesto. Mm. There's a whole lot of people who have signed that, but it walks you through how self-worship promises an awesome life. It robs us of awe. It pretends it's cutting edge. It's hopelessly outdated. It goes through a heretical critique of self-worship, but also on the flip side of that, here's a beautiful alternative of living, of following God's heart instead of our own. So jointheheretics.com, folks can check out the manifesto. There's a ton of bonus resources on there. There's even an album I recorded that goes along with the book that folks can access. There's a couple supplementary articles that take the research deeper. All kinds of fun stuff on there on jointheheretics.com.
All right, well, we'll put that link in the show notes, information about the book. Again, Thaddeus, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and then again for helping us explore these truths more clearly. And so thank you so much.
Absolutely, brother. It's always a joy to serve CMDA.
Well, this is the time of the podcast where we share some things that you need to know. First of all, if you haven't done so already, make sure you download the CMDA Student Life app. Let me tell you, this is the place where we communicate, we give you the resources and everything you need to stay connected with CMDA. On the app, you can join CMDA. And that's one thing we encourage you to do. Stay connected with CMDA by joining. And here's the good news. As a student, joining is absolutely free. But the resources you're going to get are priceless. So stay connected with CMDA by joining. Also through the Student Life app, there's resources for downloadable Bible studies. The podcast is on there. And all kinds of ways to stay connected and be informed about CMDA. So download that app and get connected. Also, one last thing that you need to know is if you want to stay connected with some of the more late-breaking news and information, we're on the socials. We're on the Facebook, the X, and Instagram. And so simply find us at the handle at CMDA Student Life, and we've got all kinds of information there as well. So as always, we look forward to talking to you next time on the next episode of CMDA Student Pulse Podcast.
Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. CMDA's Student Pulse Podcast is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the organization. CMDA is non-partisan and does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Student Pulse Podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members.